You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Iowa legislature adjourned over the weekend after passing tax bills, medical marijuana legislation, and several tax measures, among other things. Some measures, even though they were passed by lawmakers, have yet to get final approval from Republican Governor Kim Reynolds. One of the last things Republican lawmakers did before leaving the statehouse for the year was to vote to ban Planned Parenthood from getting government grants for sex education programs. Reynolds was asked this week if that policy runs at odds with her failed proposal to expand access to birth control.
Well, we're going to sit down and take a look at it. There are a lot of, it's not one or the other, and it doesn't mean that there aren't other people providing or programs providing those services. So, not just one.
Critics say this policy would reduce access to sex education. Reynolds says she'll push for her bill that would allow Iowans to get birth control directly from pharmacists without first going to a doctor. It passed the Senate, but not the House.
So I'm not giving up on that. I didn't get everything I wanted. It's not going to surprise you to know that I'm going to come back, and I'm going to also be fighting for amending the Constitution that gives felons the right to vote.
Reynolds didn't say whether she'd sign into law bills expanding medical marijuana laws, legalizing sports betting, banning public insurance from covering transgender surgery, and restricting the attorney general's ability to join out-of-state lawsuits. She has about a month to sign or veto those bills. Lawmakers passed some of Reynolds' other priorities, including a framework for a children's mental health system, funding for her workforce development initiative, and for rural broadband and housing initiatives. This was Reynolds' second legislative session as a governor, and her first after being elected. The last thing Republican lawmakers did this session was approve changes to how Iowa Supreme Court justices are nominated. The proposal would remove the senior justice from the panel that selects names to send to the governor and allow the governor to choose the majority of nominating commission members. It's a more narrow version of a bill previously passed by the Senate. Representative Stephen Holt is a Republican from Denison.
Providing one additional appointment for the governor provides a bit of extra voice to the people through their elected governor. This extra appointment does not politicize the system in any way.
Democrats say this would give the governor too much power over the selection of appellate judges. They say it would politicize the courts and erode the independence of the state's judiciary. Iowa lawmakers have sent a bill to the governor also with nearly unanimous support that would extend a statewide sales tax for school infrastructure. It would also put a much larger percentage of that revenue toward property tax relief than the current law. Republicans say it's a win-win because it funds school projects and provides tax relief. Representative Roz Smith is a Democrat from Waterloo.
I find it a bit frustrating that I'm standing here today speaking to a save bill that greatly decreases the funds that will be allocated towards supporting our school districts with their infrastructure needs. A SAVE bill that started the year with 98% of the funds going to our schools has been greatly diminished to just 70%.
Smith says he's disappointed that Senate Republicans insisted on a larger portion going to property tax relief. Almost all of the Republicans and Democrats in the House and Senate voted for that bill. And a bill Republicans say will increase transparency in local property taxes has been sent to the governor after back-to-back votes in the Iowa House and Senate. The bill requires cities and counties to inform residents when property tax values increase. Local officials could lower property tax rates if they want the city or county budget to stay the same. If local officials want or need their budget to grow, they'd have to take more steps to notify and get feedback from the public. To raise taxes more than 2%, the council or board would need a two-thirds vote. Republican Representative Dustin Hyde of New Sharon says it forces local officials to vote on the property tax rate if they want to bring in more money.
They can't say, well, we didn't raise your property taxes, your assessment went up. We're trying to take that part of it out.
Democratic Senator Joe Bolcom of Iowa City says the bill doesn't do anything to limit property tax growth, which Republicans had announced as a priority for this session.
This is a red tape machine for city clerks and county supervisors to do their jobs that they're elected to do. And they actually have the same constituents back home as we do that share concerns about property taxes.
House Democrats claim the bill will hurt the state's public pension program known as IPERS. The bill was released the day before lawmakers voted on it, and it is completely different from earlier Republican plans aimed at limiting property tax growth. Among the bills the legislature passed this session awaiting the governor's signature is one allowing farmers to grow industrial hemp. Even once it becomes law, many questions will remain. Industrial hemp was once used for clothing, rope, and a wide variety of other products. But in 1970, it was lumped in with its cousin marijuana and classified as a controlled substance that made it illegal to grow nationwide. Under the 2018 Farm Bill, though, it's now legal for states to allow the growth. Sam Funk of the Iowa Farm Bureau says it could offer a way for farmers to add diversity to their crop rotations, but there are scant details about markets and processors for hemp.
It's going to be a changing marketplace, and we're going to have to take a very close look for each individual operation as well as for the state as a whole.
One hemp seed producer in Colorado says he sees the most potential in hemp for its cannabinoid oil. As mentioned earlier, one priority of Governor Kim Reynolds that lawmakers failed to pass this year was a measure that would allow ex-felons to regain their voting rights. And the issue of ex-felons voting has been controversial in several states. Voting rights have been a major issue for activists since the 2016 election, with many saying minorities were kept from voting in several states. Josh Douglas agrees and says there are many things states can do to encourage voting and enfranchise more voters. His new book, Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting, takes a look at the issue of voting rights in general. Douglas is a professor of law at the University of Kentucky and specializes in election law and voting rights. Douglas says he wrote the book in part to dispel some of what he calls the gloom and doom stories that are often told about the disenfranchisement of voters.
I wanted to highlight some of these positive stories on making it easier and more convenient. And so, yeah, I mean, a lot of these issues were, I think, at the forefront and have been at the forefront for a number of years. But I think you're also right that they've gained steam recently in the public consciousness, which is great. It's really important.
What percent of eligible voters actually voted in the last presidential election?
In 2016, it was about 60% turnout nationwide. Of course, that differs based on the state. So some states had higher and some states had lower. In the 2018 midterms, the turnout was 50% nationwide. And that was a record, in terms of decades for midterm elections. And people were celebrating this kind of high voter engagement. And why are we celebrating when half the eligible electorate didn't show up?
That's a good point.
And so, you know, for me, it's what can we do to improve that number? Because even 50% just isn't good enough for me when we talk about having an informed, engaged electorate and a democracy that we can truly be proud of.
What do you think are the biggest obstacles for people in getting out to vote? Some people say, well, it's apathy. They just don't try hard enough. But there has to be more to it than that.
I think it's a combination of things. So voter apathy is one where people feel like, you know, my vote won't count or you know, the system already is going to dictate the winners. But there's also structural hurdles to the ballot box for many people, whether it's in the voter registration rules or just election day convenience. So I think it's a combination of all of those things.
What do you think about the whole issue of giving felons, ex-felons who've served their time, their voting rights back? We tried to pass that bill here in Iowa in the legislative session that just ended, but there were concerns on the part of some Republicans that these folks had not done enough restitution or something about their crime. Do you think that all ex-felons should be allowed to vote, should be able to get those rights back?
Absolutely. There's no reason why someone should be stripped of their most fundamental right in our democracy. And, you know, the history of felon disenfranchisement is really a history from Reconstruction after the Civil War and Jim Crow laws to cut out African Americans from the ballot box. And we can't lose sight of that history along with the present day effects, which also are discriminatory. Iowa, along with Kentucky, is now the worst in the country when it comes to felon disenfranchisement and disenfranchising felons for life. And honestly, you know, I think it's shameful. I live in Kentucky, and I think it's shameful that my state, as well as Iowa's, is the worst on the list.
You say Florida had about 1.7 million people, including 20% of the African American population, disenfranchised in the last election. Why were they disenfranchised?
Well, so Florida was on that list as well as the worst in the country that disenfranchised felons for life. But in 2018, the state's voters overwhelmingly passed a state constitutional amendment to change the law and to end the lifelong felon disenfranchisement for most felons, which this is going to re-enfranchise about 1.4 million people.
You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm talking with Josh Douglas, a professor of law at the University of Kentucky. His new book is called Vote for Us, How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. What about people that are in prison now? I was watching Bernie Sanders talk about this recently, saying that he believed that people that are serving time should have the opportunity to vote.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good idea as well. Why are we coupling committing a felony, committing a crime with this lifelong or just even while incarcerated stripping of one's fundamental right? You know, if we think of voting as the most fundamental part of one's citizenship, which it is, then why should we be taking that right away? We don't strip someone of their citizenship because they made a mistake. I think that going incrementally towards repealing some of the worst laws in terms of post-incarceration makes a lot more political sense. But, you know, you do have to ask the moral question, which is, why are we linking these two things when historically they've only been linked really because of Jim Crow era thoughts about racism?
It's interesting to me because when I was growing up, I remember people telling me that voting is a privilege, not a right. And I think that now when we have discussions about voting and who can vote and who should vote, there might be something of that still hanging on. People see that as a privilege that you need to earn, and bad behavior cuts you off from that privilege. Do you think that might be part of it?
Well, but if it is, I think it's a not the right mindset when it comes to our democracy. You know, we consider ourselves a democracy because we have the consent of the governed, which should include everyone. You don't have to do anything to earn your right to vote besides, in this country, turn 18 if you're a citizen. There's nothing else one has to do to actually earn it. Yeah, there may be things, you know, you may have hoops to jump through when it comes to registration, but it's not something you're earning. It's not a privilege. It's a fundamental right of our democracy, and we all need to understand that. And once you understand that, then you can recognize the need to make it easier, more convenient, and more inclusive to be able to participate.
Can we talk a little bit about maybe some models for improving voting? Are there some states where they're doing some specific things to help enfranchise people, to make it easier for people to vote, and that those things are working?
Absolutely. So on one hand, we can talk about voter registration and automatic voter registration, where the state has the responsibility of putting everyone on the rolls using information the state already has through DMV offices. This started statewide in Oregon, thanks to some innovative thinking by a guy named Steve Trout, who I profile in the book. He's the elections director there, who was feeling heat from both sides politically on the voter registration rolls. The left was saying it wasn't easy enough to register. The right was complaining about outdated registration rolls. And so he went home one night and thought it over and said, how can we flip this model and make it easier and more inclusive and more convenient? And he came up with automatic voter registration, where he said, you know, look, we already have this information in the state's databases. Why can't they talk to each other? And this actually improves the security of the system because it cleans up the voter rolls dynamically. Every time someone changes their information with the DMV, it also updates their voter registration information. This enfranchised in Oregon the first year they used it over 100,000 new people who got registered automatically, and many of them came out to vote, and they probably wouldn't have voted otherwise, especially if you think of some states that have a 30-day requirement. You have to register 30 days before election day. And the studies show that those states have the lowest turnout, states with the highest turnout have automatic voter registration, and this is spread now to over a dozen states.
Here in Iowa, we have you can register and vote on the same day. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that also is another great example of a reform that makes it easier to vote and has produced higher turnout. The states with same-day registration and automatic voter registration are doing it right with respect to the registration processes. You know, there's no longer a need in this day and age of technological innovations to have a lag time for registration. You don't need to check the rolls, and there are really no fraud concerns. And then, you know, you asked about states that are doing it right. There's also a lot of stuff happening in terms of election day convenience itself, not only same day registration, but some states have moved to universal vote by mail, also known as vote at home, where the state automatically mails a ballot to every eligible voter, whether you don't have to request it at all. So it's not like absentee balloting. And this is so much more convenient, right? You receive the ballot in the mail a couple weeks before election day. You have the time to research the issues, research the candidates. It produces a more informed electorate. And then you fill it out and you put it in you bring it to a secure Dropbox or you put it in the mail. Again, this improves turnout because it improves the convenience factor in voting.
You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm talking with University of Kentucky Professor of Law Josh Douglas about his new book, Vote for Us: How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. In Iowa, they passed a bill that, because of a mix-up in or a misunderstanding about when some absentee ballots were actually mailed, they decided to take up a system that goes by a barcode. And when the barcode goes on, and they can see exactly when that ballot went through. So technology has proven to be very helpful with this.
There's also a system called Ballot Trace for individuals who submit a mailed ballot to check in and watch essentially the ballot go through the process to make sure it was received and counted correctly, or at least processed correctly. These sorts of things really work. Now, a paper system still makes the most sense. I think, you know, concerns about security and hackability require us to have a voting system that still relies on paper as the most secure method, but we can use technological advances to improve the process of casting ballots in that manner. And again, states like Colorado, Oregon, Washington, all of Utah besides one county use universal vote by mail, and the voters seem to love it, and turnout goes up.
Is there anyone that shouldn't be allowed to vote? Is there anything you think that should disqualify someone?
Well, we can obviously talk about citizenship and whether voting should be just for U.S. citizens, although some cities actually do allow non-citizens to vote in things like school board or local elections. So that is a debate, right? You know, if a non-citizen parent who are legally here send their kids to the local school, should they have the ability to vote for school board? That's something to consider. There's certainly an age requirement that makes sense, although some cities have decided that 16 is the better age to start voting with respect to local elections. But beyond that, I'm not sure that there are, I guess geographic restrictions, right? You should only be able to vote for offices in your geographic area. I think those would make sense in residency type requirements. Besides that, again, if we think of the right to vote as the most fundamental right in our democracy, which I think it is, then we should espouse an inclusive viewpoint of who's in our democratic society.
What was it that really made you want to get into this topic? Was it because of what you saw going on around you? Had you been doing research in this area?
Well, I've done a lot of research in election law in general. But what was really going on that sparked this book was this sense of doom and gloom that there's so much bad news out there with respect to voting rights. And, you know, in my research, I'd heard about these stories of positive news, of good things happening on the ground in communities all over the country to improve our election system. And so I started diving in and then speaking to some of these individuals that I profile and being really inspired by their stories. These are everyday Americans who are working to improve the election system in their own communities. And so I started interviewing some of them and really just wanting to tell their stories because they were so inspiring to me. So, you know, really the catalyst was a desire to push back against this doom and gloom narrative and demonstrate how our elections are actually being improved.
Looking ahead to the next election, do you think things will be a little different now? Do you think there's more awareness? Because I hear a lot more about the issue of voter, you know, voter activism and people who are trying to make it not only easier to vote, but to expand the voting rolls to make it a bigger priority.
Well, I sure hope so. You know, and we did see an uptick in voter turnout in the 2018 midterm election. So that's great. You know, but I do think that we can strive for more to have even stronger turnout. And it takes some of these reforms can really make a difference. So I think this is a slow march toward progress. I don't think this is something that necessarily will change overnight. But, you know, I talk about in the book at the end, I say, let's espouse an ideal of something crazy, like, you know, let's say 90% turnout, which sounds absurd when we think of our current turnout numbers. You know, how are we ever going to get 90% turnout? But my view is let's strive for something like that. And, you know, and if we don't hit 90%, but we get to 75, that's pretty good compared to where we've been.
Well, you say this is really a book about stories.
Well, you know, we haven't yet talked very much about the individuals that are – the stories are so compelling. Actually, one person told me she thought it was a good beach read after reading it, which I thought was nice, a book about voting rights being good for a beach read. It really is the stories that drive this whole movement. It's the individuals on the ground who are doing this great work to improve our voting processes. And, you know, I call them democracy champions for a reason. They're really doing just such amazing things to improve our system. And so, you know, the takeaway here is it does not all have to be about doom and gloom. There are ways, nonpartisan ways, to make our system a lot better, more inclusive, and more convenient.
That was Josh Douglas, a professor of law at the University of Kentucky who specializes in election law and voting rights. His new book is called Vote for Us: How to Take Back Our Elections and Change the Future of Voting. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media, and I'm Mary Hartnett. Technology has become a big part of all of our lives and our jobs. Many of us fear technology could mean many occupations could eventually be taken over by computers. Professor of Business Administration Ed Hess shares those fears. The Darden School of Business educator and researcher is the author of several books about business and human potential, including Humility is the New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age. Hess says 80 million jobs may simply not exist in the near future.
That's the prediction basically over the next 15 years or less.
That's not very long.
Technology today can do 45% of the job tasks that are being done. So technology today can already do 45%. Now, that doesn't mean it can do 100% of, just say you, what you can do, or 100% of what I can do. But if we're working in a business and we're either in a factory line or we have a doing a job that is, you know, doing the same thing over and over, and it can do 45% of what you're doing and 45% of what I'm doing, well, let's think about this. And we're doing something very similar. Maybe they only need one of us.
Right.
And the technology does all of the, does 90% of what we both were doing, and the other person does 110%. And so technology already has the power to do lots of things that people are doing. And so those will be the jobs that we're really talking about are going to go first. Then technology is going to continue to advance, especially artificial intelligence, and it's going to move into the professions. And it's going to basically advanced to the state where the experts and experts who are not technologists, experts who are cognitive psychologists, experts believe that it is, you know, with enough data, and it's all driven by data numbers, with enough data to manipulate, technology can probably do every type of thinking that humans can do, except the creative, where there's not a lot of data, the imaginative, and all the emotional stuff, the emotional engagement with other people. And that's why many of the service professions, social workers, elementary school teachers, nurses, hairdressers, people that deliver services on an individual basis that are emotionally laden, are going to be in professions where they will have jobs. The unfortunate thing is that those jobs generally are not paid well in our society and are undervalued. And so as more people get out of work and go into those professions, all right, various professions, then you have to ask the question is the higher number of people doing those jobs going to basically drive down wages of even the people that have the jobs?
So it looks like economic inequality will continue to rise.
I think that's an understatement. If we're going to get to the point where we have a significant number of our fellow citizens who either have no work or only working part-time as giggers, entrepreneurs, going from job to job, the number of people who have full-time jobs will be the best numbers at this point probably predict 25% of the population, and maybe another 25 to 30% population will have part-time work. They'll basically find it on their own unless we have government programs like we've had in the past to put people to work in communities, and unless we devise basically a different way to go through this problem. The challenge that you're raising here, Mary, will be the biggest challenge this country has faced since World War II. It is that big, because we're talking about the future of work. If you think about it, work is through how people have basically embraced the American dream and opportunity for that they can maybe have a better life than their parents had. Maybe their kids will have a better life than them. Well, the American dream today is already a myth for many of our people. But when this comes, the land of opportunity and the American dream and our, you know, our whole way of life is going to be challenged. And we're the only major country in the world that does not have major studies underway as to how to deal with this. We are the only major country in the world, major democratic and capitalist country, that is not putting in place plans for how we're going to retrain people. When people lose their jobs, are they going to be able to do any of the skills that technology can't do? And if they can we retrain them? If people are not going to be able to retrain, or we're going to have community work programs, okay? What's going to be the way that we as a society, which is already divisive, doesn't even basically split more into the haves and the have-nots?
You're listening to The Exchange. We're talking with Darden School of Business professor Edward Hess, the author of the book Humility is the New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age. I was reading an article about all the people studied, especially people over 40 who still have full-time jobs, said that they would like to work part-time or maybe do a little something else with their lives, but so much is tied up in having this precious full-time job, because you've got health care, you have a pension, you have a 401k, you have all of these things, and having a full-time job with benefits, it just feels like something that no matter what, you don't dare let that go.
That is true. And what's going to happen in the future, as very few people will have full-time jobs compared to the population, that means healthcare in this country is going to have to be basically made available to all our citizens through a different mechanism. That means education and lifelong learning and training. Even people who have jobs, the research and the best guess at this point, even if you have a career that's even semi-professional and you have a job, in the world that's coming, you're going to have a new career every 10 years. So every segment of our population, it's the people who do not have the what we'll call the high-level careers today that are already suffering in our society. If you go back and look economically, you know, middle-class families haven't basically participated in income growth in the last 30 years. The bottom 50% of our income level people have lost income since 1980. They're making less after inflation. They're making less today than they made, okay, since 1980. 40% of adults, Federal Reserve numbers, 40% of adults in this country can't cover $400 of unexpected expenses. 60% of adults in this country have less than 1 month's income in emergency savings. I mean, we already have a very stressful economic situation. When I was growing up, I came from a very humble background. Even back then, a middle-class kid coming up had 90% chance of earning more than their parents. Today, a middle-class kid only has a 50% chance. Today, a kid born into poverty has a very, very small chance of ever getting out of poverty. This whole thing of upward mobility, this whole thing of, you know, hope for a better future, the whole substance of, you know, the land of opportunity, the whole substance of what our country has stood for is going to be challenged by what's going through. So, yeah, if you have a full-time job and you have a 401k and you have some health benefits at work, the last thing in the world is you probably want to, you know, would be taking early retirement. But what you've got to ask yourself also is, anyone like that is, what's the likelihood my job will be automated in the next 10 years? And if there's a chance my job will be automated, and if you have a job where you're doing skills that you're doing the same thing over and over again, well, let me make it easy. The jobs that are not going to be automated are the jobs that basically require the highest level of thinking. Critical thinking, problem solving, innovation, creativity, or the jobs that involve high emotional engagement with other human beings on a one-to-one basis. And trade jobs where you basically have to go in and do a diagnostic and it's going to be different all the time. And then you're going to have to come up with a solution and try it and iterate to get it right. Robots are not going to be able to do that for a long, long time. Those are the jobs that basically will be safe. If you're not in one of those jobs, if you're in a general service job or in an administrative job or in a job where you're doing the same thing over and over again, okay, the likelihood that you would be automated in 10 years is high.
And I think if you are in a job where you need to communicate and connect with people, like being a journalist definitely is one of those jobs, you still have to have such a high level of technical expertise today because you're expected to constantly learn new things and it's always evolving. It's so different than it used to be.
Yes, and you're quite correct. And if you're in that type of job, you need to be in a part of journalism where the environment and what you cover is constantly changing, because as you well know, you know, sports stories and sports scores and financial results and annual reports, those types of stories are being created today for newspapers and for radio and TV by artificial intelligence already.
When I look at all the young people today, a lot of us have kids. They're going to be graduating in anywhere from 5 to 10 years, and they'll be out there in the world. And I think going to college for a lot of them, you know, say, well, do I really need to go to college? Because look at all the people who go to college and can't get a job, but they need to be able to do something. They need to be able to think.
They need to learn how to think. They need to learn the skills that the technology is not going to learn. And basically, in order to learn that, you have to learn it with other people, because you can't learn it by yourself. You can learn it playing video games if you're playing the right type of video games. So if you call that by yourself, but the reality of it is that people are going to need that base core skills. Now the question comes down to, will they need 4 years of college, or are there different ways to learn that? And that's going to be the issue going forward, especially with the high cost of college. And there are people who are building businesses to provide that type of learning to students online and through basically real-time audio video, so live with other people collaboratively, teaching people how to think critically, how to think creatively. And in order to know how to think, you got to know how to listen. In order to know how to think well, you got to know how to manage your own thinking, what's going on in your mind, and you need to manage your emotions. And there are people that are basically building programs right now that are to do that. So the question be, how do people get to this, you know, get to that, get that type of service delivered? And, you know, will a college degree be going forward? We don't know the answer. Will a college degree be as important as having, we'll just say, a 2-year certificate, which says you are an expert thinker, an expert innovator, and you're an expert at working with people?
You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. We're talking about the future of jobs in America with Darden School of Business professor Edward Hess. He's the author of the new book, Humility is the New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age. You were saying how the U.S. is not one of the countries that is doing something to prepare for this. What do you think we should do? I mean, do you think it has to be people in Congress who are running the country, business people? I mean, what kind of a setup do you think would help in dealing with this?
I think our political system right now is so dysfunctional. It's got to be bottom up. I think it's got to be a bottom up of coming from the citizens of this country. And that's, in effect, why I'm doing what I'm doing right now, is trying to basically, you know, it's a little bit like I'm on Paul Revere's ride. It's not the British are coming. It's the technology that's coming that's going to change basically how we live and how we work. And people need to understand that and start talking about it in their communities, with their school boards, with their representatives, with their local representatives, state representatives, and start electing people that are going to basically come up with the answers. And we need business leaders and higher education leaders stepping up, talking about this. And we're seeing that with some of leaders on Wall Street, and they're coming about it talking about our existing basically economic system, in the sense that capitalism right now, in the words of those people, is leaving far too many people behind. And our model of capitalism today is different than our model of capitalism was from 1947 to 1972, 73, from the time after World War II through the mid-70s. Every income group shared in the growth and the prosperity. Since that time, most all the prosperity has gone to the top 10%, and most of it is out of that's gone to the top 1%. We've moved from a capitalist system that's, instead of shared prosperity, it's unshared prosperity. And that is putting so much stress on our system today that when we get hit with this technology over the next 10 to 15 years, it's going to be the interconnectedness or interdependence of those two things is going to put so much stress on our system, because it's going to cost a lot of money to solve these problems. It's going to have to be new educations that, you know, we need to reform our education system. We're going to have to retrain a lot of people. We're going to have community work programs. All right. We're going to basically, you know, have to, if you will, have amendments to our business laws and our antitrust laws, et cetera. We're going to need a much stronger safety nets for our fellow citizens. And all of this takes time and money. And we don't have a way of, you know, we're not dealing with that. We're not having these discussions at a national level. And I hope that you and your listeners will get involved in your community. We need a We the People's movement. And I think that the thing that I'm finding that's resonating with people believe we are a country, and what's made us different is we are the land of opportunity. And we need to keep hope and opportunity alive in our country, because we have already areas of our country where that, you know, hope and opportunity has become limited because of what's happened already with technology. That's going to spread unless we basically come together and talk about what kind of country do we want to be, and just say 2030. All right, just say 2030. Just think about it. That's 11 years from now. What kind of country do we want to be? And we're talking about the future of work, okay, the future of our democracy, the future of the American dream. And as I said, in my opinion, it's going to be the biggest challenge this country's faced since World War II. It is that big and that serious.
That was Darden School of Business professor of business administration, Edward Hess. He's the author of the book, Humility is the New Smart, Rethinking Human Excellence in the Smart Machine Age. Hess says the United States needs to prepare for a major shift in the kinds of jobs Americans will have in the next 30 years as more and more professions become completely mechanized. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. 2 years ago, an investigation started into the death of a Sioux City native. 2 months later, another crime led authorities to the man some say shouldn't have been allowed on the streets in the first place. In a Siouxland Public Media special report, Sheila Brummer explores the life of the victim through the eyes of loved ones and why his mother says her son didn't have to die.
I'm John Weisler's mom. I was.
A mother finds it hard to talk about her child in the past tense.
John was the best son ever.
A bond between the two still alive, even after death.
I heard he was a really good son.
He was. He was so good.
Linda Weisler's voice strains because of pure emotion mixed with a medical condition.
I have what's called sporadic dysphonia. Causes a tremor with your vocal cords.
John Weisler graduated from North High School in 2001, got his law degree from Iowa, then followed a different path by enrolling in the University of Minnesota to study biology.
He must have been pretty smart to do all that.
He was smart and he loved learning. He was extremely witty and fun and a joy to be around.
Weisler's wit also attracted the attention of the Vakulskis brothers.
I met him first in sixth grade, I believe it was, or maybe even before, a little before that. But we went to middle school, high school, and college together.
That's Dan.
I live in Sioux City with my wife and two kids.
Brian Vakulskis. I'm an attorney in Sioux City. I met John through Dan, and he always intrigued me because his nickname growing up was Weasel. And it intrigued me that my brother had a friend named Weasel.
As adults, the Vakulskis brothers kept close contact with their friend, a relationship built on intelligence and humor.
Be in Iowa City a lot, going to football games and such, and I would meet up with John down there. He'd become John by that point, and dropping the Weasel. And we both shared a love of reading.
We are joined today by Steve Inskeep. You'll recognize his voice.
Brian Vakulskis eventually launched a literary podcast featuring his friend.
Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We'll be back next time.
He also helped him focus on a full-time career in 2012.
I remember when he got the job because I was golfing with one of the people from Lederman Bail Bonds, and he mentioned that they were looking for somebody in Iowa City, and John was trying to find a way to stay in Iowa City and get a job. And between at Green Valley Golf Course, between holes 2 and 7, that job became his.
Oh, yeah, and he loved that job. Just completely loved it.
The position as a bail bondsman eventually brought John Weisler to the last chapter in life.
You just can't imagine what you're going to go through when you hear that type of news.
The Vakulskis brothers first heard about the tragedy from Linda.
I just can't imagine what you've been through.
You never in a million years would believe something like that could happen. Never. And John was such a kind, caring person.
After John Weisler didn't return home after meeting a client late one April night in 2017, his fiancée went looking for him. She walked in on a gruesome scene.
It was just hard for us to kind of grasp figuring out what happened to him and, you know, what maybe those last moments were like. You know, he's murdered across the street from the jail, no less, literally right across the street. And you just don't know why.
They say it was robbery. This was an execution-style shooting. He was also stabbed several times. It looked very up close and personal.
At first, the case appeared to go cold. No arrests, no known leads.
They didn't release any information for quite a long time. They never said, if they had a beat on anybody. And then 2 months later, Ricky Lilly, the cab driver, is murdered.
A few weeks after Ricky Lilly's murder, police arrested 41-year-old Curtis Cortez Jones in Mount Pleasant. Then 4 months later, a major announcement from the prosecutor in the case.
Curtis Cortez Jones caused the death of Jonathan Weisler by shooting him in the head with a small caliber firearm without justification.
Can you tell me about the man who killed your son and why you think this is a crime that should have never happened?
This monster who killed my son had been in prison on a 40-year sentence, and he was released early. I think he should have served out 7 more years, and he was granted release. He was an at-risk person to reoffend again.
Both deadly shootings happened just months after the Iowa Board of Parole granted early release to Curtis Cortez Jones. He served about a dozen years for aggravated armed robberies of 2 businesses. Documents from the parole board show a future risk for violent behavior and escape from a work release job.
For some reason, I have no idea why, but John would be alive today and the cab driver would be alive today too if it hadn't been for the Board of Parole. I don't understand it. Doesn't make any sense.
Did they ever give a reason why they did what they did, the parole board?
They had said because he has a job and he has a place to live. It's pretty flimsy.
The man convicted of killing an Iowa City cab driver will spend the rest of his life in prison without any chance for parole.
2 murder trials landed Curtis Cortez Jones 2 life sentences in 2019.
What would you like to say to the state of Iowa, to the parole board?
Hopefully you're doing your job, and in John's case, you had all of the tools at your fingertips to be able to make an adequate decision. And now you have blood on your hands because you're responsible, in my opinion, for these 2 deaths, senseless deaths.
2 years later, those who love John Weisler reflect on what might have been.
A lot has happened to me that I really wish he'd been around to witness, because if for anything, he would have been making fun of me, and it would have been just very joyous to have him around for those.
Dan Vikulskas now serves as a district associate judge, and because of his new post, can't comment on what the parole board did or didn't do.
It is completely surreal that my friend John is gone without warning. Having read that is part of John's legacy.
His brother Brian wonders what if.
This turned out to be a very bad decision, of course, looking at it in hindsight. I haven't been back to Iowa City since John's funeral, and I used to go there a lot, and I still can't bring myself to go back.
The Vikulskas brothers share more memories, details on a wedding for their friend that never was, and the love and devotion he felt for his mother.
John was so integral to her life. You know, I get sad when I see her because I think about what she lost, and, you know, we sit here and, you know, talk about how it affected us, and, I mean, it's not even remotely close to how it affected her.
I was in denial and shock for a long, long time.
Linda Weisler, a retired licensed mental health counselor, says sharing details about her son helps. She continues describing him as a smart, patient man, a good listener, whose death she hopes doesn't fall silent.
To me, it just seems like so senseless that would happen
to
him.
It just totally was, and it just makes it so hard.
In Sioux City, for Siouxland Public Media News, I'm Sheila Brummer.
Siouxland Public Media contacted the Iowa Parole Board, and in an emailed statement, a representative says the board does not comment on specific cases in which they decide to either grant or deny parole. That's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Mary Hartnett. See you next week.